From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Illinois continues to be a target of the Trump administration, which is now holding back social service money totaling about $10 billion meant for the state. That money goes to help with child care grants and money for low-income families. We'll talk more about it. Also, the governor has signed a major energy package, and can Illinois keep the Chicago Bears? We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus, and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Ben Zielinski, a reporter with Capital News Illinois. Ben, thanks for being with us once again.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
So, Ben, I'll start with you. The Trump administration has frozen this distribution of money. It's about $10 billion. We're not the only ones that are having this money withheld. Five Democratic-led states, including Illinois, are among those being targeted. This follows what's been going on in Minnesota and these stories coming out of there of some fraud, possibly with child care centers taking money and basically not providing that service. That's at least the reason being given. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. But it's also not really clear why Illinois is involved in this. You know, this is something that seems very focused on the state of Minnesota. Governor there, Tim Walz, has acknowledged this investigation and the problems that are stemming from it in state government. But it's really seemed to have trickled down to Illinois because the president of the United States said in a social media post, he believes that the fraud in Illinois is worse than Minnesota, but that was all he said. So it's not really clear exactly how Illinois became involved in this other than that one comment from the president.
Yeah, Charlie, this is very typical, I think, with Trump. He has made a lot of statements about Illinois, about Chicago, for example, without really providing any numbers or true data to back up what he's saying. But at this point, I mean, this type of thing, the impact this could have, I think, on people in the state of Illinois, because, again, we're in the middle of a budget cycle with Illinois. You're expecting this money to come in. A lot of these providers are expecting this money to come in, and now suddenly it's very uncertain.
Yeah, and it really is I guess the best way to put it is, as Governor Pritzker suggested, this is just retribution by Donald Trump against states that are led by Democratic governors. And his excuse, as was mentioned, was the fact that and some of these daycare centers being run in the Minneapolis region, the providers had links to Somali immigrants, and there was some fraud, and it was uncovered. But there's been nothing similar found in Illinois. We're taping this on a Friday morning. Thursday afternoon, Attorney General Kwame Raoul filed suit along with officials from California, Colorado, New York, and Minnesota, a federal lawsuit challenging the funding freeze. And they're seeking a court order to immediately halt the freeze and restore the funds. And here in Illinois, something like $1 billion in funding is being frozen. And the governor's office said this would impact something like 152,000 children. So it's a pretty significant thing.
Yeah, it's not just kids either. I mean, there's money in there for families, needy families. There's also money for those with disabilities, for senior citizens.
Yeah.
So it's pretty wide-ranging. And the way I guess it works now, the way I understood this, was the feds are saying that the states have to provide documentation justifying all the expenses that are, you know, that this money would go toward. They could make another hoop to have to jump through. But the fact that we're talking about fraud, Ben, I mean, and abuse, we're not saying that doesn't occur. It occurs, you know, in every state, but only these Democratic states are the only ones being targeted here. And I think that really is what speaks loudest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to point out that, you know, fraud is often caught. You know, I'm sure there are examples that do get through the cracks. But I guess, you know, as in the case of Minnesota, you know, people have been criminally charged in this fraud scandal and people have been convicted in it. So it's not like it's something that is, you know, running rampant and, you know, some sort of big undercover scheme that is trying to be hidden from the federal government or something like that. Like, attorney generals prosecute this stuff, local prosecutors prosecute it, the federal government has prosecuted it in multiple presidential administrations. So it's not exactly, some big revelation here that fraud occurs. It's just, I think, the way that the Trump administration is kind of framing this, and that they're saying, well, it's really only these five states that have some of the most prominent Democrat governors in the whole country are the only ones that have this problem, and we have to freeze the money because of that. So, it certainly just goes back to what Charlie was talking about there. There's just a lot of, it seems like political retribution is the main motive, particularly for the state of Illinois, because we haven't seen the evidence of the same things happening here as have happened in Minnesota.
And Charlie, you made a good point. We were talking before the show about the fact that the state has an auditor, and all of these programs, all of these agencies are audited in the state. And for anybody that has covered state government or really been involved with it and reads those audit reports, they do a pretty thorough job of tracking things down. They may not catch it immediately, but they catch it pretty quickly that something is amiss. And to act as though that nobody's paying attention is really a false narrative here.
I would say that is very true. Large agencies get audited annually. Smaller agencies get audited every other year by the Auditor General. And the Auditor General does not pull punches. He comes out with some really scathing, or at least back in the day when I was covering this stuff, the then Auditor General Bill Holland came out with some very scathing audits on state agencies. And there would be disagreements between the auditor and the particular agency. An agency, the auditor would say, you should be doing this and you're not. And the agency would say, well, we don't have the money to do it. But yeah, they're pretty thorough. Then there's also a legislative committee that reviews these audits to see whether or not there's changes needed in the statutes to address some of the issues raised by the auditor. So the notion that this stuff is going on, nobody's paying attention, is either the people don't know what they're talking about, or two, the people do understand how it happens, but for political convenience, they're characterizing it as something else.
Yeah, I would point out Bill Holland, especially when he was the Auditor General, it was his auditing that actually was the first, I believe, to put in writing some of the things going on in the Blagojevich administration. It started the snowball effect that later led to the indictments and eventual conviction of the governor. Anyway, let's move on because there were other things happening this week as well. We had at the Illinois State House the Republican candidate for governor, Darren Bailey. As we're talking about state budgets and spending, he had a news conference. He is, again, from all we're seeing in the polling, the front runner right now in the Republican race for the nomination for governor. He won that nomination last time as well. But he is talking, or one of the things he brought up was the idea of a state version of the Department of Government Efficiency, which was better known by the term DOGE, which Elon Musk was heading at the federal level. Talking about Ben maybe doing that here in the state if he's elected, what did he have to say?
Yeah, I think Darren Bailey believes it's an effective model to, take a closer look at state government spending to find where there is waste, and in the words of him, there could be fraud and abuse as well. I think at the federal level, we've seen that this DOGE program that Elon Musk briefly ran didn't produce a lot of results. It produced a lot more chaos than actual savings to government. There's been some reports in recent months that have shown that government spending is actually up since Donald Trump took office. And the cuts that the Department of Government Efficiency actually ended up making were actually pretty minimal, and a lot of the stuff that the department said they cut didn't really get cut. But I think Darren Bailey was trying to distance himself a little bit yesterday from that version that Elon Musk ran. And he thinks he's going to be able to put on a more bipartisan and more efficient version of this program by, taking just a closer look at the line items in the state budget and seeing what is being spent in the state. He's going to have his running mate, Aaron Del Mar. If they were to become governor and lieutenant governor, Aaron Del Mar would be the one to run this auditing program. And, he said that one of the first areas they would look is, some of these boards and commissions that are kind of obscure. The state has a whole bunch of them. And to kind of just, see what those boards and commissions are actually doing. They also threw out the idea that, there's a lot of positions in government that could be duplicative, there's services that, can be more streamlined. That seems to be where they were looking to target. They weren't necessarily saying we're going to be cutting actual state spending, because I asked if they had any ideas on that so far, and they said no. So I think that's kind of an important distinction. Darren Bailey also mentioned there's not going to be some sort of mass layoff program that we saw Elon Musk try and implement. He said that is not the goal of this program at all at the state level. So, we didn't see any federal success really hardly with this program. How it would be implemented in the state is still kind of something that remains to be seen if Darren Bailey actually became governor. But, it's certainly, I guess, just one way that Darren Bailey is kind of trying to show that he embraces the Trump administration and he wants to bring some of these ideas to the state.
Yeah, Charlie, not to the specifics of what Bailey's saying here, and I don't think anybody is out there saying, hey, don't take a close look at spending and let's take things that maybe are obsolete or could be, money could be spent better. Let's do that. But I hear this from a lot of candidates, especially challengers who are coming into the office. And yet I very rarely see anything happen for the better with that. I'm not saying it couldn't, but I just usually when I hear that, it's a lot of platitudes and there's not a lot of detail to go along with it. The budget is available now. You want to start going through the budget, take a look at it. You can do that. It's made public. But anyway, your thoughts on that, Charlie? What do you think of these ideas? They come up a lot of times in these elections.
Waste, fraud, and abuse is any program from which I personally do not benefit. And that's a cynical way of looking at it from watching this stuff for 50 plus years. But that's kind of the attitude. If it's there's not something in there for me, well, I don't think that's necessary. So I could argue that we don't need a state fair because I've not been to the state fair for, well, since my son's band stopped playing there, and I'm not going to go this year. But on the other hand, I realize it's very important for agriculture, which is an important factor in our state economy. It's a showcase for the agricultural community. There's good entertainment there. And so I would strongly urge that we continue to support the state fair here in Springfield and also in DuQuoin. But that is the thing that gets me. And the programs that are there that the, for want of a better term, the hardline conservatives on spending are programs that are there because they've been improved by a majority of the General Assembly, signed by governors from both parties, and they're on the books. And so to do away with the program, you have to change the legislation. And I don't see that there's a great groundswell of opinion that, yes, we're going to go in and we're going to eliminate these programs.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Ben Zielinski with Capital News Illinois. Well, Ben, this week, something we'd been paying attention to, waiting for the governor to take some action. He didn't do it before the new year, but he did sign this big energy package that lawmakers had approved. And this follows on the heels of a lot of people having to pay more for their electricity in 2025. We saw some really big jumps in the monthly bills. It's being touted as a way to sort of try to solve some of that problem and get Illinois on a better energy track going forward. Tell us what this bill does.
Yeah, this is a very complicated bill that does a lot of different things. And but one of the main core principles of this bill is the idea that the state needs a greater supply of energy. And this law really aims to incentivize energy storage via batteries to ideally continue to keep the supply of energy up because we are seeing a growing number of energy shortfalls here in the state. And the idea is having these battery programs will allow more energy to be more available longer term. The problem is, costs are certainly rising, and having this storage ideally could help lower costs because more energy is available. That always helps bring costs. That's the rule of supply and demand. But one of the biggest thing critics are saying about this bill is in order to create this battery storage incentive program, there's going to be an additional charge on people's utility bills to pay for that. And that's something that lawmakers say is going to be a very short-term pain. It's not going to be a ton of money. It's just going to be a few dollars on a person's bill. And they say that in the long run, this is going to lead to energy bills going down, lower than they are today. But a lot of critics are not sure that's actually going to come to fruition because that's several years down the road. We don't really know how this energy landscape is going to change because we do have so many problems with being able to create enough power for people to, use on a regular basis these days. And they're putting in a short-term cost increase right now. There is no guarantee those costs are going to come down in the future. So that's really the biggest thing with this bill, is there's a lot of hope that eventually the state's going to have more energy capacity and costs are going to come down as a result of that. But the critics will tell you that that's not a for sure thing. And I guess the one other important thing I would point out in this bill is that there's it ends the state's ban on new nuclear energy construction, which is certainly a big deal. There's another way that the state could potentially boost its energy supply by constructing more nuclear facilities because we just haven't seen the wind and the solar projects being able to generate enough energy supply to meet the demand that the state has. But I would also caution again that nuclear projects take a very, very, very long time to get approved and built. So there's not going to be a lot of short-term changes here. There's a lot of hope for the future, I think, for lawmakers and stakeholders in this, but the results of this certainly remain to be seen.
Yeah, Charlie, this is coming at the same time. We're seeing these data centers, these proposals for those going up everywhere, and a lot of controversy surrounding those, a lot of opposition in many local communities to those. So the idea is we got to get more ways to generate electricity, to store that electricity and have it available. Your thoughts on this piece of legislation?
I think, as Ben said, it's very, very sweeping. It involves, and very complicated, involves a whole host of issues. And one of the things that I think is driving this, as you mentioned, Sean, was the fact that we have these data centers that are growing, and they require tremendous amounts of energy, as much energy as a small town to power them. And the question is, do we have the generative capacity to provide this electricity? Do we have the transmission lines? So that's something that's being played out. And this legislation is very forward-looking in the sense that it encourages the battery storage that would be needed, the energy that's generated through wind and solar. You store that energy so that when, as the critics say, well, renewable stuff doesn't work because the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Well, under those circumstances, if you have these large battery storage places, that energy will be sort of banked there for when the need occurs. But one of the things I found interesting is that it creates what they're calling virtual power plant programs, in which homes and businesses with solar panels or wind turbines would pool their energy together, acting like a power plant, despite not physically existing as one. The idea is that the energy stored in these residential and business batteries can be contributed to the electrical grid when the state's major electrical delivery companies like ComEd up in the Chicago area or Ameren in a lot of central and southern Illinois, when during the peak hours, like during the summer. And the idea would be, I guess, that I would have a solar panel on my house and the energy that is there would be stored in a battery and it would be available for the grid when needed. And I would get a credit on my bill, my power bill, for the amount of energy that I contribute. And I'm pretty sure no Republican voted for this when the bill came through the General Assembly. Representative Noreen Hammond of Macomb, who's the Republican leader in the House, pointed out, as Republicans have done in the past, that energy sources like wind and solar are unreliable. And in a statement, she said the state, quote, should focus on preserving reliable energy sources like coal, natural gas, and nuclear power that actually work when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. I was going to say that they got a lot of support from organized labor, and the AFL-CIO is predicting that it would generate up to 100,000 jobs when it's fully in place. So it had broad support, except from the manufacturers who don't like it and business that doesn't like it.
So Ben, if I'm a ratepayer and I got socked last year with big increases, like you said, there's no guarantee that couldn't happen again this year. And there's really no guarantee on this legislation, this law at all, because a lot of it is very forward thinking. So it could be years before we know if what the governor and supporters are saying is true or what the critics are saying is true.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting parts of this is the governor happened to sign this bill this week. And just right around Christmas time, a number of state agencies got together and released a report on energy in the state. And one of the biggest things that came out of that report was the realization that there's going to be energy shortfalls in the ComEd region by the end of the decade, which means there could be rolling blackouts and things of that nature. Those will transition into downstate communities shortly after 2030 as well. So, you know, time is really, I think, of the essence here for state lawmakers. I know a lot of them certainly realize that. I still think energy legislation, despite this passing here in October, I still think that's going to be something that's going to be on the table again in the spring session, as they're going to be continuing to look for ways to deal with this data center problem of data centers using up so much energy.
Well, in the time we have left, Ben, I'll go back to you. Another issue that seems to be hanging out there in the legislature, a lot of people talking about it, but don't see a lot of action happening, involves the Chicago Bears getting set to play a big playoff game this week. Future home of the Chicago Bears still in doubt. There is talk about Arlington Heights. There's even now been talk about moving to Indiana. They won out of Soldier Field. So what is happening? What are you hearing as far as the latest?
Yeah, not a lot has really changed in this situation other than that the Bears dropped the threat that they will consider moving to Indiana, which certainly got the attention of Illinois or Indiana leaders, where their governor has said that he's happy to work with them. And it sounds like there's some conversations happening with state officials on the other side of the line here. But that really hasn't seemed to move the needle at all for folks in Illinois. The governor has remained committed to his position that he's open infrastructure funding for the team to help, you know, facilitate this massive construction project that would be a new stadium in Arlington Heights. But, you know, he's not out here ready to hand out big amounts of money to a private business. And the Bears are seeking big property tax breaks in Arlington Heights to build the stadium. And that's, I think, the thing they really want the most and the thing they're getting the most pushback from state lawmakers on. So this week we heard from House Speaker Chris Welch. She was the first public official to comment since the Bears came out with the news right before Christmas that they were considering Indiana. And the speaker basically said, you know, that the Bears are right. The stadium stuff is just not a priority for state lawmakers right now. They want to focus on affordability issues that actually impact the people of Illinois. And the Bears are not really one of those issues. There's only so much money going around in the state right now. And lawmakers are looking at it very carefully. They're not giving the Bears any special treatment just because, you know, they're such a treasure to the state of Illinois. So that is certainly noteworthy coming from the Speaker of the House that there's just not a lot of interest in helping the Bears out. Should things progress in Indiana, I don't know if that changes any minds and gets people to kind of think about this in a different way, but the conversations will continue to happen, but I don't expect it to be, you know, priority number one for the General Assembly.
The quote that was in the story, what Chris Welch said, he talked about there are other issues more important for Illinois residents, homeowners. And he said, and this is his quote, "I don't know anyone who has knocked on a door and someone has said anything about the Chicago Bears. We have to stay focused on the things people care about right now. When people say, what are your priorities going into the legislative session? We're trying to bring down the cost of living."
And it strikes me the way these things tend to work that when something does happen with this, if it happens, it will happen from a public standpoint really fast, maybe over a weekend.
It was interesting, too, because there was a poll, WGN-TV, Emerson College poll, taken the first week in January of 1,000 Illinois residents. One of the questions was, how important is it to you that the Chicago Bears stadium stays in Illinois? 58% said yes. It's either somewhat or very important. Then the question, would you support public funding for the stadium? Roughly a third said, yeah. 58% said no. So they want the Bears to stay, but they don't want to have to pay for it. And I think that's reasonable. You look at the McCaskey family, the Bears are, they're a multi-billion dollar operation. And for them to be saying, well, you have to pay us to move our stadium, and we have to be guaranteed that we're going to make money on it, or we're going to go somewhere else. The idea that the Bears are going to have a stadium and it's going to be approved this legislative session is less likely than the idea that I will be signed by the Bears.
Let's move to our notes from the field. Ben, let's go ahead and start with you this week.
Yeah, I will go back to that poll that Charlie mentioned. And that was pretty wide-ranging poll that included some numbers about the Democrat primary for U.S. Senate. And what we really learned from that poll is it's a kind of a runaway race right now for Raja Krishnamoorthy, which is a little surprising given, you know, there's three big names in this race, along with U.S. Representative Robin Kelly and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. But right now, Raja is polling at 31%. The next closest candidate is Juliana Stratton at 10%. So that's a big, big gap, with early voting beginning in about 25 days or so. And, you know, we just really haven't seen much of a campaign from either Robin Kelly or Juliana Stratton as far as getting on TV, because I think everyone knows if you turn on the television, you're going to see a commercial from Raja right now. So I don't think those numbers are as high as Raja would like them to be. I know, you know, some of his internal polling is showing him above 40%. So I think there's actually, you know, a little bit of worry on their end as well from this, but certainly notable that right now he's running away with this race. And unless Juliana Stratton and Robin Kelly can find a way to push out some more advertising to really start to mount a pretty serious campaign here, there's a lot of ground to make up in kind of a short amount of time.
All right.
Hey, Ben, how many undecideds were there in that poll?
Yeah, there's 45 undecideds in that poll. So there is, you know, a pretty big chunk of people who have not made up their mind. But, you know, if the only name they're seeing out there is Raja Krishnamoorthy, you know, they may just not even be aware of who Robin Kelly and Juliana Stratton are.
Yeah.
All right. And Charlie.
Well, the Illinois Flash Index finished the year holding steady, according to Professor Emeritus Fred Geertz. He reported that earlier this week. The December reading of 101.7 was identical to November's, down slightly from a 102.4 reading in December 24. So the professor who compiles the index for the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs said that these figures indicate a slowing but still expanding Illinois economy. And in a related piece of good news, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which is the legislature's fiscal gurus, released their report, their monthly report, and they showed that the general fund receipts through the end of December, which is halfway through the fiscal year, were up $1.2 billion, 4.8%, over the same period, the first half of the last fiscal year, FY 2025. The overview suggested that there is overall confidence in meeting the FY 2026 revenue target that was used to build the current budget. But they also said that there's uncertainty remaining regarding the broader economic and behavioral impacts of the legislation that President Trump signed, and how these recent tax changes, federal tax changes, may affect Illinois.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Ben Zielinski with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.